This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Did you ever have the feeling that you've lived this day before?
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god, I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender, I am an immortal.
Bill Murray's character in the movie Groundhog Day has lived the same 24 hours over and over again. And today, on Movies on the Radio, we're talking about those films which you have watched over and over again. You know the one, you quote it to your kids, comes on television, and for some reason you just cannot change the channel. It has the perfect line that you recite over and over to your friends. Everybody knows it. They hear it coming. Joining us now to talk about the things that make films great and the reasons we see films over again for Movies on the Radio, film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura. Good to have you.
Thanks, Frank.
Also, Marcia is the film, a film professor at not the god, but a god, goddess at the North Carolina State University. Welcome back, Marcia.
Wow, that's quite an introduction.
There you go.
Frank.
Hey, I want to be a god.
Local two goddesses here on Movies on the Radio. So what do you think it is, Laura? I'll start with you. It's crazy, right? Because we know how it ends. Stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. And we think there's something about the end that should be a bit of a surprise. And yet.
Well, I think the anticipation of seeing your favorite parts over and over again, it's like, well, do you like opening your presents on Christmas or do you like thinking about them before you open them? And I think for the movies that you watch over and over again, it's like, oh, now they're going to say this. Oh, now they're going to do that. And the pleasure of that anticipation makes it a experience worth repeating.
I don't want to invoke Freud here, but, you know, Freud talks about the compulsion to repeat and that there is this kind of reassurance about repeating things, especially that are comforting to us. And so I think that one of the interesting things to consider is the way that the movies we see over and over again shift throughout our lives. I mean, obviously, we have the movies we see as kids that delight us or scare us that we want to avoid, and then the ones we want to see that make us feel good. Then we have our teenage movies, and then as we go through life, they shift. And it's interesting to think about the ones that stay constant and that you're happy to come back to, and the ones that you go, I never want to see that movie again. I watched it 100 yeah. times, and I'm done with it. So I do think it says a lot about us as individuals and how we evolve over time, what the films are that we're drawn to, and you know what kind of pleasures they give us as we watch them.
And I think also movies that you see at different ages in your life, and they mean different things. Like, I loved Vertigo the first time that I saw it, but as I got older and older, the meaning within the film shifted for me as I became a different person. So the film remains the same, but as you change, it seems like the film is changing.
Yeah, you know, and it can be disappointing as well. I remember when mm-hmm. I was very, I don't know how long.
Do not watch Easy Rider ever again.
Oh, no, that's horrible. That's right. You watch that again.
I disagree.
There are some moments in that film that just embarrass me to think I ever liked that. And but also, as a little kid, I saw It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I must have been like 7. And I thought it was hysterical. And then it came on again. I was 15. I said, oh, I love this movie. And it was embarrassing.
It is the longest movie ever made.
I think humor is one of those things that does change. I mean, what's funny to us, you know, when we're 12 is typically not the same thing that's funny to us, you know, when we're 40 or 60 or whatever. So I think that that is.
Which is why if you give Monty Python and the Holy Grail to a 12-year-old boy, you've struck gold.
That's right. So, but if he turns 16, you're out of luck. Well, let's listen to some of the things that our listeners found watchable over again. Here's our first one.
This is Annette Ebright from Charlotte, North Carolina, and the movie I watch over and over again is The Princess Bride. The reason I watch it so much is that it has everything: fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love, and miracles.
And we are at an impasse.
I'm afraid so. I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brains.
You're that smart.
Let me put it this way. Have you ever heard of Plato? Aristotle, Socrates?
Yes.
Morons.
Really? In that case, I challenge you to a battle of wits.
For the princess? To the death? I accept.
Good. Then pour the wine.
I have watched it so many times that I wore out the original VHS copy that I had and had to replace it with a DVD copy. The sword fighting scenes in that movie are so wonderful. They really show the use of music to accentuate the action on the screen.
Annette Ebright loves The Princess Bride.
Well, I think there's two things about this. One is I was surprised how many listeners said The Princess Bride.
Yes, it is a popular favorite.
Very, very popular watch. And I brought this up with a friend the other night, my friend Katrina, and she was saying immediately, quoting lines from the film, and, you know, I've got this one. And I was like, wow, you really know. And people know this film inside and out. And it's got those great kind of witty lines that are very easy for someone who's seen them over and over again to quote. The second thing I would say that's interesting is I really like that this listener talked about the VHS issue and wearing out her copy. I had a conversation with my undergraduate students at NC State the other day, and I made a joke about, like, well, who has VHS players anymore? And about half of them raised their hands, and I said, I'm sorry, what are you talking about? And they said, it's because we watched the Disney movies.
Exactly.
We grew up with the way we used to see them. They want the original format for them of the way they saw them. And some of those films have not been reissued on, I guess, Blu-ray or DVD. So they are wedded to a really outmoded technology so that they can have that experience from their childhood.
And that's absolutely true. And the different thing about it is now it's Mulan and a beer. where you weren't watching those movies that way when you were a kid, but they are such a deep, those Disney princess movies are such a deep, comforting thing for this particular cohort of girls.
And I think for The Princess Bride, too. I mean, I think a lot of people like watch that with their kids because it's kind of, you know, tame entertainment, but then they also could enjoy it because it does have a pretty witty
But it's
script.
It's a fairy tale that's one step more sophisticated than the Disney movies. And I think that's why you feel a little regretful about, you know, you don't want to be wedded to your childhood favorites, and The Princess Bride incorporates so many of those wonderful qualities, but just for a slightly older audience.
And it's arch. I mean, the way the sound effects are used, it's a sort of a characterization or almost satire, the way some of the stings are used in that. So you can kind of rise above it and let your kids enjoy the fairy tale while you remember that, oh, fairy tales are sometimes overdone. They're sometimes melodramatic. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on. There are many, many more. Why don't we hear our second choice?
My name's Penny Sandbeck. I live in New Bern, North Carolina. Probably my most favorite movie among many, I love movies, is a 1980s film directed by a Scottish director, Bill Forsyth, called Local Hero. It's a movie a lot about loneliness and about the connectivity of human beings.
Would you give me a pound note for every grain of sand I hold in my hand? Now you can have the beach for that. Saved you a pound or two, eh?
Come on, Ben, I don't want to play games. But negotiate in a business-like way.
Oh, dear, you could have had a very nice purchase there, Mr. McIntyre. I can't hold much more than 10,000 grains of sand in my hand at a time. Did you think it would be a bigger number?
It's a really great movie. It's kind of a cross between Frank Capra and Wes Anderson.
Yo, Local Hero.
And this movie is no longer in print on DVD or VHS. So this is another thing about your favorites is if they become inaccessible, then they become, this fantasy that you can never quite obtain. You remember loving it, but you can't see it anymore.
Well, and I think in the case of this film, I think what's really interesting is the way that the listener talked about this film being about loneliness. And, you know, when you think about why do you want to watch something over and over again? Well, one reason is to be entertained, like The Princess Bride, right? I mean, another reason is to kind of experience feelings and emotions that are important in life and to think about them and the way that they reflect back on your particular situation at a given time. And sometimes it can be a really sad, poignant film. I think a lot of the range I saw in responses to my queries about this were, you know, films that made people cry and films that make people laugh. I mean, they tend to have those extremes as opposed to films that are kind of flatter in their affect.
Let's listen to a third one because I think it in many ways sounds some of the same themes as we heard with Local Hero.
My name is Nathan Lovin. I live in Durham, North Carolina. And the movie I want to see over and over again is not actually one I want to see over and over again, but it's one that I have seen a lot. It's Garden State. It's a very melancholy movie, and I'm actually drawn to it when I'm feeling melancholy myself. Strangely enough, it doesn't make me feel sad or worse. It brings me up. I feel a lot better after having seen it.
What are you thinking about? You're not coming back, are you?
Come on, Sam. Of course I am.
No, you're not. You don't realize this is good. This doesn't happen often in your life, you know? I mean, this... We can work this stuff out. I want to help you, you know? We need each other. I haven't even lied in, like, 2 days.
Is that true?
No.
Incoming! But you know, these last two films remind me of something you said, Laura. The idea that in The Princess Bride, there are these lines that you can quote, and then you sound witty. Right. Mm-hmm. So having seen this film, I'm now armed with something new and I can go out and I can feel witty because I recite this line and I know it's funny. Compare that to seeing a film that's going to have an emotional effect on me. It's not that I'm going to repeat this feeling, but it actually changes me in the watching. Is it completely?
Well, it empowers you to overcome these kinds of situations in your own life. And I don't know, people watch Jimmy Fallon. He was talking with Lena Dunham about the movie that they've watched 100 times, a movie I'd never heard of called Man in the Moon, introducing Reese Witherspoon. So as it happened, it came up on my Netflix queue, and I watched it last night. And she's a tomboy who's in love for the first time. There's a horrible farm machinery accident. Ooh. It's a movie that, you know, if you come to it when you're not at a certain age, it's like, why would you watch this 100 times? But Lena Dunham talked about how she identified so strongly with the lead character, you know, at her awkward age. And in the movie, she cracks nuts and eats. And she said, I would sit on my front step cracking the nuts and eating them. And it was so I could be like the person in that movie and I could overcome the things mm-hmm. that she overcame.
Well, and I think that's so one of the things that films do typically is they have a narrative arc where people do overcome things, right? Not always. There's the tragic endings, but there is something moving and reassuring about that. And so I think sometimes that's a reason that people feel connected to a narrative. But there's also, I think, for some of these films that are about loss, and I mean, you know, Garden State is, it's about loss and about estrangement and about, you know, just being a little dysfunction, being a little person trying to navigate the world. I mean, sometimes too, I think we see these films and we also reflect back on the way that, you know, maybe our lives are a little better than that. Maybe we've been through something like that, that we've already made it past us, and it makes us feel better also about our own situations.
Today on Movies on the Radio, we're talking about films that you have seen over and over, and here's our next selection.
This is Ellie Baldini, and I live in Winston-Salem, and the movie that I can watch over and over again is Clueless, and I can watch it so many times because I have a huge crush on Paul Rudd. I always have from the first moment that I saw that movie. And I love the fashion. It's the epitome of 90s fashion. And it also reminds me not to take life too seriously every time I watch it, because Cher is just kind of floating along, doing her own thing, and I think that's a good motto for life.
Isn't my house classic? The columns date all the way back to 1972. Wasn't my mom a Betty? She died when I was just a baby. A fluke accident during a routine liposuction. I don't remember her, but I like to pretend she still watches over me.
This is a great time capsule film, too. I mean, I like that the listener talked about that because, I mean, for me, it was the 80s and like Pretty in Pink and, you know, the John Hughes films that really resonate with me in that, like, wow, that those are of the moment. Molly Ringwald is, you know, the actress of the day. And this is another version of that, you know, with Alicia Silverstone and this version of Jane Austen.
Right. It shows how Jane Austen's plots are just so excellent, can be used in any sort of situation.
And it can be a send-up, and yet it's about popularity in high school and these other kinds of things that have more substance
to
them.
And wanting to fix other people's lives.
Yeah.
But that also gets to another reason I think that people watch films over and over, because they're time capsules. It takes them back. So even if the film itself maybe wasn't the best film or wasn't their favorite for a particular reason, it so captures that moment that they, you know, that we all want to be part of.
You know, there's a relatively recent film that I really like called Hot Tub Time Machine, which is, you know,
really, Marsha?
Yes.
Tell us more.
I've said it on the air. John Cusack is in it, but it is a film that is about what Frank just said, which is nostalgia for an earlier time, in this case, the 80s. And these characters that go back into this world of high school and like where they were, they remembered as being, of course, so much better than it actually was. And going back in time, Chevy Chase is in it. Don't knock it until you've seen it, and then you can knock it. But it's about that very, very idea of nostalgia and what it meant to be alive in a certain decade. And we all have that decade that, you know, for better or worse.
I'm actually nostalgic for a period that I never lived in. It actually predated me, but I'm with Sean on this one. Let's listen.
I'm Sean Moore from Apex, North Carolina, and one of my all-time favorite films is The Maltese Falcon, and I've watched it many, many times because it's always entertaining to me. It's a perfect film to me. It is considered by many people to be the first film noir, and it definitely has those elements of a heroic character being in conflicted circumstances.
I've no earthly reason to think I can trust you, and if I do this and get away with it, you'll have something on me that you can use whenever you want to. Since I've got something on you, I couldn't be sure that you wouldn't put a hole in me someday. All those are on one side. Maybe some of them are unimportant. I won't argue about that. But look at the number of them. What have we got on the other side? All we've got is that maybe you love me and maybe I love you.
You know whether you love me or not.
Maybe I do. Well, I'll have some rotten nights after I've sent you over, but that'll pass.
It's a great ensemble cast. They make the material work and makes it come to life. And every time I see it, it's just, even though I know it's happening, I know what happens in the end and everything, it's still exciting for me to see, and I get a lot of entertainment out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I like that Sean brought up that idea, even though I know what happens in the end, because isn't it funny, our reaction to movies? On the one hand, I know from introducing films, if you give away something that happens in the film, people get mad. I mean, they get really, really mad. And yet, for your favorite film, there is not a single surprise. And if there is, that's a problem, right? So there is this kind of weird conflict between wanting to be surprised and then really enjoying already knowing what's going to happen, especially for something that you've already enjoyed once before.
Well, some people have been complaining. Turner Classic Movies, they just show the same things over and over again. But honestly, if I'm, you know, I do not want to watch Pawn Stars or, you know, whatever. If the Maltese Falcon is on and yep. I'm spinning the dial, it's like just a little piece of heaven yeah. that Turner Classic Movies has given to you because everything about this movie is so perfect.
Yeah, and I think as Sean pointed out, that the performances are so great. I mean, you can hear that in Bogart's voice. And Peter Lorre, we didn't even get to here, right? You know, one of the great character actors of all time in one of his great roles. So there is something about watching, you know, a truly magnificent performance that is very gratifying.
People at the top of their game. And yep. it's the studio yep. system yep. at the top of its game, too. I mean, everything, the costumes, the photography.
Dashiell Hammett's sound, novel based on.
Everything about this is a time capsule of a vanished time, not just, you know, visually, but cinematically as
and
well.
You get the sense that this is a quintessential film about something. Even if you had never heard of film noir, didn't understand what these kinds of novels were all about in that period, you'd get the sense that this captures a moment in American mm-hmm. literary and film history, mm-hmm. right? Is there something, would we not watch The Sting? It's funny, The Sting didn't come up at all. Maltese yeah. Falcon came up a lot. Yeah. Both have surprise endings as the big hook, but The Sting, it's like, yeah, once you know, really, I don't want to go back to that. This.
Well, I remember The Sting, you know, being a film that I watched a lot as a kid. I think it came on television a lot, perhaps. And, you know, I watched part of it not too long ago, and it was one of those films I went, wow, really? This was, it didn't age well to me. Now, I have not sat down and watched the whole thing, so maybe I'm being a little bit unfair, but this film, there's yeah. no aging in a negative way. It's all, it just seems to retain its powers.
Yeah. The Sting holds up pretty well.
Does it?
But it's no Maltese Falcon. Yeah.
It wasn't the ending that made him big.
Sorry.
We're going to take a break right here. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Movies on the Radio continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about movies on the radio with our film experts, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Marcia Gordon is a film professor at North Carolina State University. And we're talking about those films that you have watched many, 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 many times. We talked about a number of films and a number of different, some that kind of all of us know and maybe a lot of us have seen, others that perhaps not as many have seen. Let's take a look at what Carlos liked.
My name is Carlos Case, and I live in Wilmington, North Carolina. One of the films that I've seen the most times in my life is a documentary called The Decline of Western Civilization. And it is a kind of a time capsule of punk rock subculture in Los Angeles.
We do get shows occasionally, but it is getting harder. I think there's a lot of bands now, and when we were first doing it, there weren't that many bands. And a lot of the new bands are just more cooperative as far as doing a sedate, safe stage show. There's no threat of an imminent riot.
What you see in this film is you see incredible performances, unleashed, kind of rabid, unpredictable, violent performances, many of which are willfully poor, you know, willfully obnoxious and poorly executed. But you also see this world in which these people live, which is these crazy squats that are covered in graffiti and there are beer bottles everywhere, and they're basically living this kind of teenage dream. I wouldn't call it a utopia because there's way too much anger and hostility and misanthropy there, but it's a kind of magical view into something that is so kind of threatening and intense that you can't look away.
I love that somebody chose a documentary and a music documentary, too, because that, I mean, music is another thing, right? The albums you listen to over and over again. And this Penelope Spheris documentary is just a fantastic glimpse at this moment, in this place, this kind of music. And I totally understand and know a lot of people who this was a very seminal film that they watched over and over again.
I feel like I know a little too much about Carlos, though.
Well, if you really wondered why you'd see it over and over again, I mean, just listen to the conflict. Well, it's a teenage dream. Well, not utopia. Actually, it's dystopia, you know. And I mean, it's all of the angst that is his youth.
Well,
perhaps,
and is also thinking about what punk rock, you know, was and is and how it, you know, that was
how it was formative in his life.
Exactly. Exactly. And how it changed, you know, and it became so mainstream after the 1980s. So this is telling a story about that before it became normal.
Well, here's another film that was so bad it was good, according to Skip Elsheimer. Let's listen.
I'm Skip Elsheimer from Raleigh, North Carolina, and the movie that I like to watch over and over again is Big Trouble in Little China. And the reason why I have watched it so many times is because it was on cable television, and it is a movie that still holds up in my mind as one of my favorite action movies.
Green explosions, people flying in and out. That was not real. I want to talk to the cops. I want my truck. Where the hell am I?
My office. Sit down.
What, you sleep in your office?
What I need to get straight is, I mean, were these guys, I mean, these storms, what are they, magicians?
Yeah, sort of. It's hard to explain. Try real hard.
Here, drink.
What is this?
It's protein powder, skin milk, a little dried seahorse, and some ground deer horn.
Oh, come on. Huh? Forget it.
Hey, Burton, suit yourself. It's your body.
If the storm's half a mile here, then there's only one place they could take her.
Lopan.
Yes.
Lopan? The godfather of Little China, Mr. David Lopan. You mean the David Lopan who's chairman of the National Orient Bank and owns the Wing Kong Import-Export Trading Company, but who's so reclusive that never mind he controls a dozen restaurants, movie theaters, and funeral homes and supports candidates from both major parties. No one's even laid eyes on this guy in years?
Hey, I have. I ran my truck straight through him this morning.
Straight through him?
Who are you anyway?
Well, I'm Margo Litzenberger. I'm with the Berkeley People's Herald.
Hey, not a bad rag.
There's lots of slapstick. There's lots of humor, a little bit of martial arts, and it's just something that holds up over repeated viewing.
Skip,
Lordy.
The AV geek who's been on the show talking about home movies, those are films.
I have a tremendous admiration for Skip, but, you know, he did not mention a couple things. One, Kurt Russell's pecs, which I think actually play the greater role in this film. I mean, I think this is a film, if you didn't see it at the right time in your life, you're never going to get it. And I speak from experience having just watched this film over the weekend. And I don't get it. And I think I know this is a huge cult film. People love this film. It's got this kind of campy quality to it. And I think if you saw it at the right time in your life and then saw it over and over again, I totally get why this would be this kind of nostalgic film.
This particular film should win an Academy Award for the greatest amount of backstory packed into one sentence without taking a breath.
Well, it's like a riff on those 1940s action movies, which clearly has evolved from the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark thing that Steven Spielberg.
And this
started.
Is John Carpenter, you know. Yeah. So this was, you know, major director of the decade. So,
but we've gotten to the point now where we like films because they're arch, because they're really over the top, and we've seen so many other films. There's such a history now in film that actually watching films pimp other films is a good time, you know, good night out.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk with you about your favorites, Marcia.
So this is really hard because, of course, there's a lot of films I've seen over and over again. So I just had to kind of pick randomly from my particular archive. So I picked one of my favorite Warner Brothers Depression era musicals, Gold Diggers of 1933.
Here when hay the army may, he's the ice gaze, Ronnie say, old man, the ideation pray, we are a ooh, 3-1, the assay on rail. And when we see the end, the art full of glaze, the eye gay, I pray in the eye, we're in the money, oh, I'm on honey. Let's let it, set it, rolling around.
And that is Ginger Rogers singing in Pig Latin and then going back into English in this wonderful, wonderful opening number of this film. And I love these Warner Brothers films from the Depression era. And this one, it has wit and it has grit and it's got great numbers. And the women have these amazing money costumes and that you think they're putting on this big show. And then it turns out that they're actually not able to put it on because they don't have the money to put it on. And, you know, you have Ginger Rogers, you know, it's the Depression, dearie, at the end of this scene. And it's one of those films that just, to me, the combination of really great writing, really great fun performances by a tremendous ensemble cast of all kinds of the best character actors of the day, and really kind of cagey, playful stuff.
It's great music, great wisecracks. I mean, you certainly model yourself after these, you know, wisecracking dames from these 1930s.
We wish to be. We wish to be that witty. It's also a pre-code film, so there is a lot of kind of really kind of racy dialogue as well, but in a, you know, a 1930s very innocent way, I would say.
Laura, what about you?
Well, I really am very fond of Singin' in the Rain, which is another musical that was made in the early 1950s looking back at the end of the silent era.
Why, you rattlesnake, you. You got that poor kid fired.
That's not all I'm gonna do if I ever get my hands on him.
I never heard of anything so low. Fine, fine. Looks great. What did you do it for?
'Cause you liked her. I could tell.
So that's it. Believe me, I don't like her half as much as I hate you.
You reptile.
Sticks and stones may break my bones.
I'd like to break every bone in your body.
You and who else, you big lummox?
Now kiss her, Don. That's it. More. Great. Cut.
Oh, Donnie, you couldn't kiss me like that and not mean it. Just a teensy weensy bit.
Meet the greatest actor in the world. I'd rather kiss a tarantula.
But you don't mean that.
I don't. Hey, Joe, bring me a tarantula.
Here you
so
go.
This was a scene in which they were filming a silent movie, so of course you would not hear what they were saying to each other. But my personal story about Singin' in the Rain is that after I graduated from college and I didn't have a job, I was down to my last dollar, which I spent on going to a screening of Singin' in the Rain, because that just seemed like such a symbolic offering to the universe that I was going to give my last dollar to this movie.
It's a good thing you were not disappointed.
Well, I've seen it many times already.
Well, it's, you know, and the central musical piece in this film, which happens halfway through and takes up a huge portion of the film, is truly extraordinary, really kind of modeled in some ways on Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes, which is also an incredible film. And it's just a magical number, whimsical, dreamlike, and, you know, you know, has incredible style. And Gene Kelly, I mean, what a dancer.
So. Yes. And there are lots of musical numbers that people know from it. I mean, when they think of Singing in the Rain, they think right. of Gene Kelly singing in the rain. But right. in fact, there's a lot of humor and dash about the entire plot.
It is interesting that we want to see these periods. I mean, I joked about being nostalgic for a period I never lived in one with the Maltese Falcon. But you're saying kind of the same thing. There's something about that.
Most definitely. That's what the movies is all about. It's time traveling.
It's time travel. And really loving a particular period and wanting to see that thing acted out or the represented, however Hollywood did it over and over again. My favorite film, no, not necessarily, this is not my favorite film. This is the film that I've seen over and over and over again. It's Midnight Cowboy. And the reason I saw it over and again, because I was an usher. I was an usher at the Lowe's Buffalo Theater. Now, you know, it's 1969. I'm in Buffalo, New York. It's a city in decline, miserable decline, Rust Belt city. It's an old vaudeville palace, this theater. We're wearing tuxedos that I would have cleaned about every 3 months.
Wow.
It was amazing. And so when I saw this film, I have to say, I didn't like it at first. It was a little weird. I was maybe 16 years old, and it didn't come together, and the scenes were kind of disjointed. Couldn't quite figure out what was going on. The acting was riveting. And so I'd see as much of it as possible, you know, Dustin Hoffman, John Voight. And so you couldn't take your eyes off of them. But I had a hard time understanding, you know, what it was all about. Here, just give you a little taste then of Midnight Cowboy.
Look, with these gals that want to buy it, most of them are old and dignified. Social register types, you know what I mean? They can't be trotting down to Times Square to pick out the merchandise. They got to have some kind of middleman. And that's where old Daniel comes in, you know what I mean?
Hey! I'm walking here! I'm walking here! Up yours, you son of a bitch! Don't try me that way!
Worry about that. Actually, that ain't a bad way to pick up insurance, you know.
Here you go, Joe. There's Ratso Rizzo, Ever the Con Man, meeting the naive Joe Buck from Texas. Here's the thing. In watching it, because I had to, because I got paid $1.65 an hour to watch it, I began to see that there was a theme. Something was going on, and that this was indeed a beautiful love story. And the idea that it would be two men in these extraordinary circumstances made the theme far more sublime and important. But that came to me about 16th or 17th time through.
Right. And that, I mean, I think one of the things that people realize when they watch films over and over and over again is that it does liberate you from a certain kind of focus on story, plot, character to observe other things about film that are very, very interesting that aren't always just on the surface. And
like just being able to watch the people in the background reacting to what the main actor is doing.
I love doing that.
Yeah.
I love
doing
that. But also, this film was part of a really important movement in American cinema in the late 1960s and early 1970s, this kind of new wave of filmmakers dealing with kind of important, relevant subjects of the day and doing so in a style that was kind of both realist and then also modernist at the same time. And so even though you were terribly overdressed for the screening in your tuxedo, I can understand why it would have resonated with you and seemed different.
And also when he said, you know, I'm walking here. This is what everyone feels when they're overwhelmed. Right. You know, it's pay attention to me. I'm a person too. Just don't run me over.
Oh, it was just all of the imagery in this film was so powerful, but it never added up. And I do blame the film because there's also a theme in the book that I learned much later that never came through in the film, which was, and why this didn't occur to me, I'm not sure, but I do blame the film for this. It really played down the homoerotic part of this film, that their relationship was, in fact, a homosexual relationship. And for some reason, it was the film deliberately obscured that. Maybe the reason was it was 1969.
It was the censorship of the day that would not permit that to be shown.
That would absolutely not have happened. And you would not have seen it in a mainstream American theater, that's for sure. Actually, that's a film. It would be interesting to see that film remade now because it would not be the same film because of, you know, the different tolerances we have even in a mainstream culture.
Brokeback Hustler.
Oh, nice. Laura's starting her screenplay career today.
Well, then, for that, you get one more pick.
Oh, yay. Okay. Well, I really love Bollywood movies, particularly of a certain era. My key era is 2002 to 2006.
Wow.
Bollywood movies are, they call them masala films, and it means like they talked earlier about The Princess Bride. There's love, comedy, tragedy, action scenes, and of course, plenty of music. And this particular clip that I've chosen is because they repurposed Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman with the Punjabi beat.
And it goes on.
It goes on, yes,
and on,
yes.
And on, and on. These are long movies.
Well, this is a film called Calho Naho, which means tomorrow will never come. It's set in New York City, in Queens, where some of the leading characters introduce Indian food to New York, which obviously Indian viewers would think might actually happen. They don't realize there is already a lot of Indian food in New York. And there are a lot of films from this era, Doom 2, Bunty or Bubbly, Bluff Master, If I'm Feeling Sad, you can just lose yourself in them.
I want to close with our good friend Art Silverman, who has long been associated with and was for many years the director of All Things Considered. He's still on the program. Art has probably the greatest sense of humor of any human being I know, so that when he saw us post this, he just couldn't resist.
This is Art Silverman. I live in Washington, D.C. and work for NPR. The film I chose is 1964's film Empire. Now, this is a film made by Andy Warhol. And it's actually just 8 hours of continuous, actually slow-motion footage of New York City's Empire State Building. It's shot from quite a distance away, and mostly at night. So not much changes frame to frame, but it's one of the best films of a tall building that I've ever seen. It's really unmistakable, and it's consistent. A lot of people, you wonder about where films are going or, you know, what it means. This one is completely, completely obvious. I saw this film first with my wonderful high school English teacher, Roberta Payne, who packed us into her Volkswagen Bug and took us to the New York Filmmakers Cinematheque, which is behind the New York Public Library at the time. They showed a lot of experimental films there, and she was always very cautious because they could be a little risque, and she was always cautioning us, you know, don't tell your parents about that scene in the shower, or don't tell them about that, you know, that gay couple or anything like that. This is in the 60s. But Empire, I could have gone on, and she wouldn't have cared. And that was one of the great things about this movie. I'd see it a million times.
Now, I detect a note of sarcasm in that particular response. And in defense of experimental film, let me say that there are, yes, that may not be the best example for a newcomer to experimental cinema, but there are a lot of great non-commercial experimental films that people do watch over and over and over again and love very much. But that is a pretty funny story, I have to admit.
Well, and the Empire State Building is not erotica. Oh, please. I mean,
I know. But 8 hours, once you've seen it, really, you've seen it.
It's like the Viagra version of the Empire State.
Laura, Marsha, always a pleasure. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Marsha Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Next month, Movies on the Radio takes a look at patriotic films. We're going to push this close to the 4th of July, so send us your favorites or least favorite patriotic film. We'll take either one, the one you like the most, the one you like the least, SOT@WUNC.org. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.